Since 1960, there have been about 40 missions to the Red Planet. Not all of them were successful. This next mission, though, is pretty special. InSight will land on November 26th. We're talking now with Dr. Stephen Lee. He is a space scientist here at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. Dr. Lee, how is the InSight mission different than the rest?
All of these previous missions have given us a lot of information on the geology, on what the atmosphere is made of, weather patterns, how the atmosphere is leaking away into space. We've never probed deeper than about 5 inches under the surface. The focus of this mission is to look at what's inside Mars rather than what's on the surface or in the atmosphere of Mars. So this will tell us what the interior is made of and what the structure is.
Now, it's a red planet, so I have a hunch that it's probably a bit of iron.
There's a lot of iron in the surface. The surface is mostly lava flows, and they rust. And that's possibly where a lot of the oxygen went in the early atmosphere, is it's all tied up with rust on the surface.
How far down will InSight be able to probe?
The entire planet. It can look at seismic activity. So if a meteorite hits the surface, the inside of the planet sort of rings like a bell. And by very precisely measuring those signals, they can tell all the way to the center of the planet what the structure is. It's layered like an onion. Is there a big core? Is the core molten or solid? And those are the big questions that we're trying to answer.
Isn't that one of the theories of why Mars lost its atmosphere, is that its core cooled, therefore the planet lost its magnetic fields?
That's exactly right. If we could look at the Earth for a second, we know from seismic probes as well that the Earth has a very large nickel iron core. And part of the core is molten, and we think that that's moving and it generates the Earth's magnetic field. And so we're protected by this bubble of magnetism, and it keeps the solar wind away. It keeps a lot of the radiation from the galaxy away from us. Mars, it looks like, lost its molten core a long time ago. And so if we have this solid core that doesn't support generating a magnetic field, and since that's gone, the solar wind just tears away the atmosphere. Not at a fast rate, but over geologic time, you could have lost a lot of atmosphere.
So Mars could have had an atmosphere at one point, which would have made the surface of Mars totally different.
That's what we think. I mean, it still has an atmosphere. It's just very thin. Currently, it's equivalent to being at about 100,000 feet altitude on the Earth. It's something like 0.6% sea level pressure. But we see all sorts of geologic features that look like water was running across the surface. There were lakes, maybe oceans. In order for that to happen, the atmosphere would have to have been probably a third to a half as dense as the Earth's atmosphere, which is hundreds of times thicker than what it is now. That says that it was a very different place. It was warm. It was possibly wet. It maybe supported life in the sense of bacteria or algae, things like that. So that's really what's driving us in our exploration, is to look for the old Mars and figure out what it was like, what was happening back then, and how has it changed over the billions of years since that early period.
So when there's seismic activity, it can give a clue as to what's at the center.
It's like doing seismic surveys here on the Earth. Anytime there's an earthquake, we have these seismometers all over the world, and they can collect these signals, and very quickly you can say, this is exactly where the spot is that triggered the earthquake, and it's 20 miles down and under Indonesia. So that's what we're going to try doing with Mars. The difference is we have one seismometer on the InSight mission, not thousands of them across the planet. So it's much harder to decipher the signals. But with time, we can do that.
You can't triangulate because there's not multiple pieces of equipment, but you can, using just one over time, make the same conclusions?
Very similar conclusions, and they can sort of triangulate. Anytime you've got an interface where the material changes, so you've got the iron core and then it goes to a silicate mantle, you get reflections where those layers meet. And by looking at the details of the signal, you can say, well, this is the primary signal that the object hit that we see, but then 45 seconds later, we see a repeat of that signal coming from a different direction. 5 minutes after that, we see a very similar signal coming back in, but weaker. And so by doing all the bookkeeping on these signals,
eventually you figure it out. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Lee, space scientist here at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, about the InSight landing on Mars on November 26th. In addition to seismic studies, what else can they find out about the red planet?
Well, there's another major instrument. It's a heat flow experiment, and it's actually the first time we've been able to really drill under the surface. And so it's got this, like a pile driver, a little hammer that pounds a probe down into the surface. It can go 15, maybe 18 feet deep. And along that probe, it strings out a cable. And on that cable are temperature sensors. So they can see how the temperature varies over whatever distance we have. And that tells us a lot about how much heat is inside the planet and how it's flowing out to the surface. And in turn, that gives us an idea of how rapidly Mars is cooling off and how much heat did it have originally. All the heat more or less came about when the planet was formed, either by the impacts of the various blobs that grew into Mars, or radioactive material that's incorporated into the planet. They all give off heat, and that's been leaking away for 4.5 billion years. So now we're trying to figure out how much is left.
This machine, InSight, about how big is it?
Oh, it's 20-ish feet end to end. It's not really large. It's, you know, a mini bus type thing. It's got two solar panels that look like Japanese fans on either side of it. So that's how it gets its power. And it's got the core spacecraft that has the landing legs and the rocket engines they use for landing and the electronics, the instruments. It's got a robot arm that can grab the seismometer and the heat flow instrument and move them out onto the surface and position them right where they want to be. And it's got several cameras. It's got a package measuring the meteorology, the weather on the planet.
So it's still doing some surface level work, even though its main function is to dive a bit deeper.
That's right. I think sending any spacecraft to the surface of Mars, it would be absolutely criminal if there isn't at least one camera on board. So they've got two cameras.
Where on the planet is it going to land?
It's a volcanic area called Elysium. It's a very, very flat plain. We don't want it to be on what would appear to be big boulders everywhere, because that really complicates the interpretation of the seismic signals, because you'd get reflections off all of your local geology. And also, it makes it a safer place to land. You don't want to have a bad day and, you know, everything's flat, but suddenly you have a bus-sized rock that you come down on.
What are some of the perils that InSight could run into on its way to and landing on Mars?
Well, the initial peril is just getting off the ground. The rocket launch is historically a very dangerous part of the mission. Rockets blow up, they don't function properly, you don't make it out of Earth orbit. So that's problem one. It succeeded there. Problem two is you have to cruise for 7, 8, 9 months between the Earth and Mars. And in that time, the sun could cough up a huge solar flare and fry the electronics on board. So you have to transit the distance safely. And then the final part is, it's called the 7 minutes of terror, where they have a heat shield and the whole spacecraft is sealed up in looks like a cone. Comes in heat shield first, it smashes into the atmosphere at about 15,000 miles an hour. The atmosphere slows it down. The heat shield heats up to something like 3,000 or 4,000 degrees, so that has to work. And then when it's going about twice the speed of sound, it pops out a parachute and slows itself down even more. And then when it's, I think it's a kilometer and a half or so above the surface, it ignites these rocket engines, it slows itself down and comes to rest on the surface. And we've had, you know, past missions on Mars that did that. I think the ones that come to mind that are, you know, a lot neater are using the airbags like Spirit and Opportunity did, or the sky crane approach that Curiosity did, where it's got a rocket-powered helicopter and then it hovers above the surface and lowers the rover down on a cable. Those are really neat, but they're very expensive and very technically difficult. We had a success back in 2008 with the Phoenix mission. So just looking at it, this is a twin of Phoenix. It's got different instruments on board, but the spacecraft itself, the technique of landing are the same.
Go with what works.
That's exactly right. You design these things with a lot of robustness built in. So if one thing fails, you want to be able to work around it or still have 99% of the machine continue working. And what you don't want to have is a whole bunch of single point failures that could kill the mission. And so that's something they've learned over the years of how to do this. Part of it is, as we talked about, the reusing the design of the lander is when you get something that works, you tend to keep using it unless there's some really good reason not to. They also typically make what's called a mass model of the spacecraft, so it's the same weight as the spacecraft. They throw it out the tail end of an airplane and pop the parachute and make sure that it comes down at the appropriate velocity. All of the electronics are tested, and then once they've actually put the spacecraft together, they test it as a package. The one test, I always love the name, it's called thermal vacuum and launch testing or something like that. So the colloquial version is it's shake and bake testing, because you put heat lamps on it as well as freeze it to the temperatures it's going to encounter on Mars or cruising to Mars. And then you have to worry about the vibrations when it's launching and the vibrations as it lands and things like that. So we do the best we can to actually test the hardware. And then there are lots of dress rehearsals of the control team, the people that will be, you know, monitoring the systems as it comes into land. They do quite a few dress rehearsals, and there's somebody running the test that throws a problem in, like, we're off by 10 kilometers in our navigation. How do we recover?
I understand InSight has a Colorado connection.
Well, it certainly does. It was born in Denver. It was constructed at Lockheed Martin down in Waterton Canyon. And many of the Mars missions have been built here in Denver, going back into the 1970s. The very first landers, the Viking missions in 1976, they were built by Martin Marietta, which is now part of Lockheed Martin. If you want to explore Mars, Denver is a really good place to be.
Are you going to be there at Lockheed Martin during the 7 Seconds of Terror?
We will be doing an event here at the museum, so we may be tying into Mission Control at Lockheed, but we'll be watching it live here. We have the NASA television feed, and we'll have a panel of an engineer from Lockheed who worked on the spacecraft, somebody from United Launch Alliance who helped launch the spacecraft, and myself and another scientist that study Mars. So we'll be able to give a good overview of what's happening and why we even want to do things like this.
Is that open to the public?
It is.
That's wonderful. What time will that be at?
It lands at about noon Denver time on Monday, November 26th, so the Monday after Thanksgiving.
And I understand that schools can tap in remotely through our special programming here at the museum.
That's true. So they can see our panel. I would hope that we're going to have a way where they can post questions and we will try to answer at least a couple of them.
I think that's exciting. In your professional opinion, Dr. Lee, how far out are we from a manned mission to Mars?
Ever since I was in graduate school in the 1980s, we've been 15 years away from a manned mission, and I'm not entirely sure we're any closer now, but I think at least we have a plan in place for NASA of what is going to happen over the next decade, and that's putting a small space station in orbit near the moon, and then once we start sending astronauts routinely to that space station. It's called Lunar Gateway. Then they'll start landing back on the surface of the moon, and that starts proving the technologies that we would need for a Mars mission. Optimistically, it'll be sometime in the 2030s. What is always the biggest question mark is getting the funding to do it. Congress is always very good at this. We want you to do these things, but no, we're not going to give you any extra money to do it.
And that complicates things.
It does. And, you know, these things are not inexpensive, especially when you put a human on the tip of that rocket. You really want to make sure that it's very reliable.
How much did InSight cost?
I think it's $600 million, something like that. And where I always lose track is if that includes the rocket or not, because that could be better part of $100 million for the rocket.
Why is it worth all that money and time?
Fundamentally, we're trying to figure out how we got here. We want to understand how the Earth was formed, how the other planets were formed 4.6 billion years ago. We've got one example to look at up close, and that's the planet we live on. And so by going to these other planets like Mars that have a lot of similarities to the Earth, but they still are very different, we can study how they were formed, and that gives us a much better picture for the formation of the solar system. There are just so many questions left to ask, and each one of these missions can only answer some fraction of those. There's definite order to everything, and it's just up to us to figure out what that order is and then start filling in around the edges of the things that don't quite fit into the easy explanations.
How long is the mission?
It's designed to last 2 years, 2 Earth years. So that's more or less 1 Mars year. They hope in that amount of time to have a dozen or maybe 2 dozen impacts on the surface. We think that's about the right number of what we've been seeing in the recent past. And so that gives us enough events that we can really analyze and confirm the observations. The way these things work is if you get near the end of primary mission is and the spacecraft is still healthy, then you propose to NASA to keep it operating. I think in particular, this mission is one that would really gain from an extension, is every one of these events you get, especially for the seismic experiment, that helps you unravel all the other ones. It gives you a much higher, it's called signal to noise, so you get a much better signal and start sorting out the background noise.
How many instruments are currently active on Mars?
Let's see, there's 2 rovers that are on the surface, the Opportunity rover and the Curiosity rover. There's 6 or 7 spacecraft orbiting Mars. I'm involved in one of the earlier missions, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. I'm part of a team that built 2 of the cameras on board. And so since 2006, I've been getting data back from Mars orbit. It's still operating. So every week I'm looking at new data from Mars. And my role on the mission is to act like a weather satellite view of the planet, where I stitch together tens of thousands of these little images that we take into a global view of the planet. And that gives us a history of how the weather has been operating, how the surface has changed over time. The fun thing with that is this is the type of imaging we do from the Earth in telescopes, much fuzzier from the Earth. But we've got 140 years of maps of Mars, and so we can go back that far and start comparing our, what happened last week to what happened 100 years ago and start coming up with the longer-term patterns. The neat thing about having this constellation of spacecraft is the rovers and the lander, including InSight, they use these spacecraft overhead as communication satellites. So it's much faster to communicate over a short distance, a couple hundred kilometers, than it is to transmit the data all the way back to the Earth. And so when one of these spacecraft flies overhead, then the lander or rover sort of burps out a bunch of data that it's stored, and the orbiting spacecraft records it, and then the next chance they get, they transmit it back to Earth.
Dr. Lee, thanks for taking time to talk about the InSight landing. We will see you at the November 26th panel. We get to experience these 7 minutes of terror with you and our expert panel.
Thanks for having me. Go InSight.
Woo!